This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with a special guest, Venezuelan Supreme Court Justice Vegas, here in our studio.
He'll tell us about the People's Constitution, and he was also an eyewitness to the coup.
Down in Georgia, the war on drugs continues to racially profile. We'll have attorney Vinita Gupta from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund give us an update.
You'll hear another sordid tale of using the so-called war on drugs to go after communities of color. Shades of Tulia, Texas.
We'll be joined by Professor Bertol Ullman from New York University. He'll tell us about the newly formed International Endowment for Democracy.
Bertol wants to bring democracy home to the United States, not the, quote, fake democracy that the U.S. is trying to export abroad. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
This is Michael Ratner at Law and Disorder. A couple of weeks ago, we actually forgot to tell you that one of us has actually changed jobs.
We didn't forget, Michael. There was a technical error. It didn't make it.
Okay. Well, it was a technical error, Dahlia. Yeah. But the person, I guess you can all guess, who changed jobs is the person who just responded, Dahlia Hashad. Dahlia was, for a long time, what was your original job?
I was in the ACLU's campaign against racial profiling, their Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Right. A great title. And that's the capacity in which I met Dahlia, who did great work traveling across the country counseling Arab South Asians and Muslims.
Yeah.
After 9/11.
After 9/11. It was remarkable, and she did a great job. And as a result of that, doing a great job, she got offered an amazing job at Amnesty International, one of my favorite organizations.
And
Dahlia?
And one of mine, too. And that's where I am now. And I'm really happy to be there. Right now, I direct the U.S. program for Amnesty International. And so you all can go to the website and find me there.
Amnesty International's website is what, Dahlia?
AmnestyUSA.org.
And Dahlia, give us an example of some of the programs you'll be working on.
Well, any human rights violation that you find in the U.S., we are hopefully going to have some type of program on it. We're just developing our capacity. So if you want to volunteer out there, go to Law and Disorder and reach out to me through our website, lawanddisorder.org. We have great volunteers all around the country and staff working on issues like prison conditions, police brutality, war on terror, of course, Katrina, even other little things like child life without parole. And if you have another suggestion, something you think we should be working on, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out to us through lawanddisorder.org.
And Dahlia will still be doing 9/11 issues.
Absolutely.
As well. And feel free to talk to her and call her about that stuff. Well, at least email her. I mean, it's great. I mean, Amnesty International is probably the leading grassroots human rights organization in the world.
Our listeners should know we're all cross members. All three of us are all members of the Lawyers Guild. We're all members of Amnesty International. And
we're all supporters
of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We work together on this. And it's real nice to see you causing so much trouble down in Washington, Dahlia.
Yeah, thanks. That's the other big move I made. I am down in Washington, but I come up to New York about once a week. So I'm back and forth frequently.
Some people say that the city of Washington itself is a human rights violation.
Well, you know what Kennedy said? He said Washington had all the efficiency of the South and all the charm of the North.
Mm. Well, I'm discovering it all. I was just actually in another very charming city, Austin, Texas, for a racial profiling and human rights conference. Yeah, everybody's been talking about Cynthia McKinney these days, but I had my own Cynthia McKinney incident, so I'd like to say a special hello to our listeners out in Houston, KPFT, and Ernesto Aguilar, the program director for KPFT. Hello, welcome, and I would like, as you all pass through the Houston airport and you're listening to the announcements that say, over the loudspeakers that say, if you say anything inappropriate, you could be arrested. So watch what you say. I don't think they actually say watch what you say, but that's the implication. I'd like you to pass by the restaurant. I think it's Bubba Shrimp or something, where I had trouble getting served. White people around me had no problems getting served, but I kept calling out, excuse me, in a very loud, assertive voice. My waiter just kept walking right by.
You were sitting alone at a table, Dahlia?
I was sitting alone at a table. I was actually coming back from a racial profiling human rights conference in Austin at a layover in Houston. I was starving. You know, tried to get served, got a menu myself because he wouldn't bring me one, and sat down.
And there were white people sitting at other tables around you.
Oh, white people came in after me.
Even after you,
white people came in after me. They got served. So finally, I got so tired of saying, excuse me, I actually screamed really loudly in the
restaurant.
Great
for you. Good.
Excuse me! And he turned around and looked at me and walked away.
Amazing.
And so then I'm saying, okay, you know, and I'm going through the conversation in my head. And this is when I want all listeners who've had similar experiences, I want you to log on to lawndisorder.org, hit our blog, and tell us what you do in these situations or what you would have done in mine. And it's so funny because, you know, a lot of people of color have this experience, and you sit there thinking to yourself, what is it that I'm going to do? And I'm thinking to myself, I could walk out of the restaurant, but I'm starving, and this is the only place where I can get decent food, and I'm just hurting myself. So I could walk out of the restaurant, or I could sit here and I could say something before, but then they might mess with my food. So I could leave no tip, but then that just kind of bolsters this stereotype that people have about people of color and tips. So I could tell him, I thought to myself, well, I could say to him after, you know, when he brings me the check, listen, you have a choice. You can bring me your manager and I can tell him what happened, or I can leave you no tip. And then I thought, I'm sitting there and I'm eating. I'm thinking to myself, why does everything have to be a fight? I mean, I fight for a living. I fight for other people's rights. I fight for our rights. And I'm tired. I've been working all weekend.
You just wanted to have something to eat.
I just wanted to eat.
Not have a fight.
You know, and I was sitting there and I was just thinking to myself, you know, I look really great. I'm wearing a really expensive dress and carrying a really expensive bag and wearing this great jewelry that incidentally was given to me as in honor of my accomplishments, that I've worked so hard, and congratulations on your new job and your new position that you got at an incredibly young age because you've worked so damn hard, and I can't get served in a restaurant. So in the end, what I did is I left him a 15% tip, which is, you know, New Yorkers usually leave more, and I just walked out. Yeah, Bubba's Seafood Grill, I wanted fish. That's
okay,
right.
If any of you listeners out there have had experiences at Bubba's Seafood Grill, it may only be in Houston, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was in the Houston airport.
Maybe it's a chain. We should look up and whether it's a chain. Bring it to our attention, but bring any of these experiences, as Dahlia says, to our attention, because I think this goes on all the time in this country, and people are just unwilling to surface it enough.
Yeah, do it on our blog so our listeners can, not just an email to us, but on our blog,
and we'll
so that other
back
people
next
can.
Week.
Yeah,
I remember as a child. I mean, I can't tell you because I don't want to tell how old I am. But in 19, but
I'll tell. He's 63.
The mid 50s,
and so are you, Michael Smith.
We used to go to Miami, and I still remember as distinctly as yesterday. At the Miami Sea Aquarium, there were signs that said, one of them said colored only,
yeah.
One of them said white. I mean, everywhere we went in the South, even in the mid-50s, after Brown v. Board, after 1954, was still rampant, done by still signs. Now it's done, obviously, in other ways, the way they're doing it to you, Dahlia.
Yeah, but at
that
point,
just by saying, you know, don't sit here if you're not white. And I remember our plane had to make an emergency landing once at the Jacksonville Airport on the way down to Florida, and the blacks on the plane who were coming with us from Cleveland had to go up in the balcony and sit because they didn't allow blacks to sit in the main room.
Yeah.
This is mid-50s.
No, I know. I mean, I remember going down to Miami with my family, and one of the hotels down there had a sign that said no dogs and no Jews.
Right.
And no blacks.
But they do it differently now. Yeah. They don't do it with
and
the
it
signs. They do it by simply ignoring you when you sit down
or
and,
giving
and
you
saying
a
you're
look.
Not welcome.
Right? You know, this morning I came here, you know, I took Amtrak to get here so that I could be with you all, and the waiting room was full. And the one empty chair was a, you know, white woman had her cup of coffee sitting on it. So I walked up to her, you know, very nicely. I said, "Is this your cup of coffee?" And she looked at me and she said, "Yes." And she finished, and I stood there, and she finished eating her muffin. And then she moved it. A white gentleman next to her is staring at her like, "I can't believe your attitude. Like, what the hell is wrong with you?" She finished eating her muffin. And, it, you know, I'm just staring at her. And then she, you know, and then she moved her cup of coffee, and she was clearly incredibly irritated that I would have the right to sit down before she would have the right to occupy the only empty seat with her coffee. And, you know, incidents like this happen all the time. And for people of color, it is a constant question, how much does my race play into this? And you can't always tell. More often than not, people are having a reaction to you where you have no idea how much race plays into it, but it is constant degradation. And I think most white people, it's something that they could never really understand what it feels like on a daily basis. I'd love to have this conversation online, lawanddisorder.org. A few days ago, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit accusing federal prosecutors of racial bias in a drug sting last summer in Rome, Georgia, where South Asian drugstore owners were targeted and South Asian clerks were targeted and arrested for selling legal substances that eventually could be used to create a substance called meth. White drugstore owners and white clerks, however, were left alone, even though they're the majority of drugstore owners in the area. White-owned and operated drug and convenience stores and operators like Walmart and Costco were left alone. They took the very small percentage that was not owned by white people, that was owned by South Asians and operated by South Asians, and targeted them exclusively. 49 places were targeted. 44 of them were South Asian. With us, we have Vinita Gupta of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Vinita is an attorney and a former law school classmate of mine who has been working on drug policy litigation and racial profiling for the last several years. Vinita, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad I could make it.
Yeah, we're glad, too. We know that you're in an airport coming back from a lecture in Virginia for the Indigent Defense Bar, so we're especially pleased that you could come join us.
Yeah, thank you. And excuse me in advance if there's some background noise.
Okay. We can take a little background noise, but we're happy to have you. And we wanted to know, what's going on in Georgia?
There is a set of cases out of Rome, Georgia. It's in northern Georgia, the small town, where over the summer of 2005, a group of informants working for the Drug Enforcement Agency actually made visits to South Asian store owners. They're in this area, about 20% of the convenience stores are owned by South Asians. The remainder are owned by white store owners. These informants, who themselves had been convicted of meth and who had something to gain by helping the prosecution get cases against these store owners, went in into stores and started to purchase amounts of legal products like Sudafed, like matchboxes, like aluminum foil, in just a couple of numbers above the legal amount. Georgia had passed a new meth law where a very vague law that made it illegal for store owners to sell, for instance, you know, anything more than two bottles of Sudafed. A lot of the South Asian convenience store clerks and owners actually had very little English proficiency, so when the informants would come up and approach them at the cash register trying to buy five boxes of matches, for instance, And in a number of cases, the informants used language like, "I'm going to use these to make a cook." The store owners, and frankly,
wait, I'm sorry, I don't know what that means. I'm going to use this to make a cook. What is that?
Yeah, well, and that's that's actually a big problem. What you just said, because frankly, I didn't know what that means either. But apparently, in meth slang, that means to make meth.
Yeah, our producer, Michael Smith, they know what that means very well.
You're kidding? I bought so much Sudafed last year, I haven't had a cough in 12 months.
Well, yeah, well, you need to be careful to not store up on the medicine anymore. But it's a situation where folks who barely understood English, let alone the slang that was being used to refer to making meth, were being targeted in the small town. And out of 49 arrests that were made of convenience store clerks and owners, 44 South Asian, 32 or 34 of whom have the same last name, Patel.
There's a lot of Patels out there, but that's still incredibly striking. Wait, so you're telling me South Asians only own about 20% of the convenience stores in Rome, Georgia, but that sounds like they were the majority of people targeted?
That is absolutely correct.
Was anyone else targeted besides South Asians?
No, this was a drug sting that basically targeted South Asian convenience store owners. There were four white convenience store owners who actually got reduction in pleas for giving information. And, you know, there are a lot of Walmarts and Costcos and large retailers in the area. The law enforcement did not attempt to conduct any kind of meth investigation into those large retailers where you and I can both imagine they are selling large amounts of legal products. It's a really tragic situation because these are folks, many of whom are not U.S. citizens, who are now, because of the charges being levied against them and because of their lack of chances of succeeding in federal court, are taking pleas, which is maybe resulting in things that U.S. citizens would find bearable in terms of, you know, house arrest for 6 months or probation for a year, but under our immigration laws makes them immediately eligible for deportation. These are folks who are taking pleas in federal court, and the INS is literally waiting for them outside, ready to detain them.
Vanita, if they didn't take a plea, what kind of sentences would they be facing?
They are facing 25 to 40 years in prison. I mean, this is...
For selling Sudafed and matches?
For selling legal products. And I'm not saying these are not individuals who are even selling hundreds of bottles of Sudafed. Literally, there are cases that are being made on allegations that the convenience store clerks in a couple of incidents sold four bottles of Sudafed where the legal threshold is two.
Wow. So how can places like Walmart and Costco sell Sudafed and other types of medication like that and get away with it?
Allegedly now, under Georgia's new meth law, those stores are not supposed to be able to. What's distressing to me is why the most vulnerable community, we see this over and over again with the war on drugs, law enforcement will take the easiest route to make easy arrests without really thinking about how to solve the drug problem. If Georgia has a meth problem, which it very well may, how is arresting the most vulnerable residents in a rural part of Georgia, residents who barely speak English, going to solve the meth problem? These aren't public safety solutions.
But, Vanita, it sounds to me like this is more than careless enforcement of drug laws. If you're telling me that 44 of the 49 people charged were Indian, and I understand that 23 out of the 24 stores that involved in the sting were Indian-owned, South Asian-owned, it sounds a little bit more than just careless drug enforcement. It sounds like profiling, racial profiling.
This is absolutely racial profiling. And, I mean, this is, when I say that it's easy law enforcement, I think that this is not a new tactic in the war on drugs. I mean, you know, in the cases that I was very heavily involved in Tulia, Texas, again, law enforcement uses racial profiling and uses racially biased tactics to basically target the most vulnerable community.
And why do they do that?
They make easy arrests that way. A lot of law enforcement actually gets dollars per arrest made, so there's actually an incentive built into the system that in order to get federal dollars, the more arrests you have, the more money you get. In this kind of situation, it was like in other cases. These were multi-jurisdictional law enforcement operations that were targeting brown people. And I think there's right now in the current climate, there's such an anti-immigrant sentiment that possibly the U.S. attorney felt like this would be an easy target. In targeting South Asians in rural Georgia, it's hard for me not to think of the overlap between the war on terror and the war on drugs as using criminal laws in order to achieve deportations is something we're seeing on the rise now in this country.
Vanita, this is Michael Smith. What can you do to help these people who have been victimized?
Well, there has been a tremendous grassroots effort, which I want to commend folks on the ground for. There's a racial justice campaign against Operation Meth Merchant, which is a multiracial now coalition of organizations, led by South Asian local organizers who have been working with the family members to educate and train them as to their options. Unfortunately, a lot of the defense lawyers who are representing these individuals have no concept of how immigration plays into criminal justice. And so a bunch of South Asian lawyers went down to do a training with defendants to let them know about what the immigration consequences are. Of course, we can't represent these individuals they're represented, but at least to secure them with the knowledge of how immigration and criminal justice interact. And to we've been marching. There have been rallies. There have been op-eds in all of the Indian newspapers to try to get support from the South Asian community. There was a meeting of some of the folks from the racial justice campaign with the U.S. attorney to really push him to drop the prosecutions in light of all of the racial targeting information that has come to light.
Any results?
No, the U.S. attorney kind of unsurprisingly said that, you know, no amount of rallies, even if there were thousands of people at the courthouse, would persuade him to do anything. He is only looking at the facts and the law, which is fine. So then now, this past week, the ACLU filed a motion that contains the facts and the law that, to any sensible lawyer, really makes out a case for selective enforcement and proves, because an informant actually admitted in an affidavit that he had been told to target South Asians because of their language issues, that these would be easier arrests. And so there's evidence now coming out. It's taken enormous amounts of investigation, and I think that we need to keep the pressure on. I think that it is never okay for law enforcement to engage in racially biased practices, and we need to hold them to a higher standard. If Georgians really care about the meth problem, this is not the way to go about it.
Vanita, I'm curious, is this happening in any other states that you're aware of?
Well, this is what is really hard for me right now is, and I think for a lot of the organizers like Deepali Gokhale, who's in Atlanta, and Deepa Iyer, who's with SALT in Washington, D.C.
South Asian Leaders for Tomorrow.
Yeah, South Asian American Leaders for Tomorrow. We are all now getting calls from individual store owners, from convenience store owners, and I got a call just a couple of days ago from the daughter of a man who owns this convenience store in Tennessee who's just been arrested for the sale of precursors.
Precursors are Sudafed and matches?
Precursors are basically a legal term given to the legal products that could be used to make meth.
Okay.
And this family is just devastated. We are now getting more and more phone calls from people in Texas and North Carolina who are saying that similar tactics are being used as were employed in Operation Meth Merchant. And this is why it's really critical for the civil rights community and for people who care about having common sense drug policy to actually really resist and fight the racial profiling that's going on in this kind of tactic.
Vanita, what can listeners do if they want to get involved or show their support?
Listeners should get involved with the racial justice campaign because there is a lot of work for individuals to do.
How do they reach them?
They can reach. There's a website, www.stopomm.org. It's stopoperationmethmerchant.org. And get involved in the campaign. There's a lot of grassroots work in Georgia, but I think that there's a reason for listeners all over to get involved because this is going to become a national problem if we don't stop it now.
I have one question on that. You mentioned, and when you first told the story, this is Michael Ratner, when you first told the story, you mentioned Tulia, and you said you did some work in Tulia. Could you just draw some comparisons for our listeners and remind them what happened to Tulia in Texas?
Sure. In Tulia, Texas, about 46 individuals were arrested on the uncorroborated word of a very corrupt undercover narcotics officer by the name of Tom Coleman, who without any corroboration at all just made accusations against these individuals, 40 of whom were African-American, in a town. Basically, it was, in effect, led to the arrest of over 15% of the town's black population. Made accusations that these individuals had sold in between 1 and 4 grams of powder cocaine. There was severe signs of racial targeting again and racial profiling. And yet, because of the nature of the drug laws, even though individuals initially tried to prove their innocence by going to trial, they were getting convicted in very little time because the juries were not able to hear any of the background information about Tom Coleman, about the fact that he had been arrested himself for committing theft and abuse of official capacity. And there was a long list of racial bias information presented actually by former law enforcement witnesses. And the juries never heard that until we were able, through a coalition of lawyers, to put the evidence on in an evidentiary hearing. And so, to me, there are strong parallels because these are people in both Tulia and in Rome who are people of color who are being accused of very low levels of drug involvement and who have really no adequate evidence against them, and who, because of the fear of the punishment that is hanging over their heads, the individuals in Rome, Georgia are now are pleading. And I always tell people, because people who don't know the criminal justice system believe that when a person pleads, they are truly guilty. Because of our drug laws and how draconian they are, people take pleas for all kinds of reasons. It's usually a very calculated cost-benefit analysis, and the risks of being sentenced to prison for 25 years are very real and very serious. And unfortunately, pleading guilty usually reveals very little about one's guilt or innocence in our current criminal justice system.
I want to add to our listeners that a movie is coming out about the Tulia cases, and Vanita Gupta is being played by Halle Berry. So when the movie comes out, I hope Vanita will come back on Law and Disorder. I have a clip from a documentary that we can play for listeners.
Is anybody playing Randy Credico?
I don't know. We could find out.
But probably you know, Randy.
I definitely want to say it took a coalition in Tulia of a lot of people, including the William Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice and LDF and ACLU and a lot of good people. And the same is going to be needed in Rome, Georgia. So I hope that we can get as much support as possible.
And we're going to encourage people to go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, where we're going to have information on how you can get involved in fighting Stop Operation Meth Merchant, the campaign.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Vanita.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
As a result of the new 1999 constitution in Venezuela, significant democratic reforms have been occurring in that country. The National Lawyers Guild is hosting a U.S. tour of Venezuelan Supreme Court Justice Fernando Ramon Vegas Torrealba. He provides, on his tour, a historical overview of Venezuela, a constitutional comparative analysis of democracy before 1999 and after, as well as recently enacted laws in the country. We are delighted to have him as our guest today. Justice Vegas was appointed to the Supreme Tribunal of Justice in August 2004 and assumed office on January 2005, where he sits in its electoral chamber. He is an expert in commercial relations and helped negotiate various international trade agreements with companies doing business in Venezuela. The Justice is a published novelist and writes regular columns for newspapers and journals. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Justice Vegas.
Thank you very much. I like that name, Law and Disorder.
The new Constitution was the first in your country's history to be drafted with the participation of the people. How did they share their ideas with President Chavez?
You know, it was a very, very curious phenomenon that happened there, you know, because people really got involved with the Constitution drafting. People would send from all over the country their ideas through letters and emails and communications, or directly by taking them there. They identify themselves so much with these constitutions. It is strange that you find people in a barrio that will tell her that she wrote down Article 345, because if you check on it, you'll find that three last words of the article, second paragraph, for example, are the same ones he had, and she will show you a piece of paper when it stated the same thing. So they just feel that's their own instrument, and that it's not only a feeling. They really exercise the rights that are established in that constitution.
They must be justifiably proud, then, of this constitution.
Of course they are. Of course they are. Also, the opposition is proud of it because they use it a lot.
How does this constitution factor into making improvements to human rights issues in Venezuela?
it's a very progressive constitution in human rights matters, you know. For example, if a convention is signed that goes beyond whatever is established in this constitution, that whatever it's set in this convention prives over the constitution should be applied before the constitution.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is really amazing.
Explain what that means.
That means if a fundamental right established in the constitution about whatever, elections, health care, and in a convention, they go further than whatever is said in here in this constitution, the constitution is disapplied and you apply the convention. That's what it means.
Yeah, that's fabulous, because here, as you know, in the United States, we sign on to conventions. A lot of times we don't.
But
by
conventions,
we
you mean treaties?
Treaties.
Or conventions. Yeah. Or
international conventions, of course.
International conventions or treaties, and don't apply, or in President Bush's case, actually try to pull out.
Yes.
That's really fascinating.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
Pretty amazing.
And in human rights matters, some states have not signed some convention, or at least have not ratified the convention, but yet they pontified about human rights and tried to tell the people how to keep things going about human rights respect.
Justice Vegas, this is Michael Smith. In this country, particularly since 9/11, we've seen just a horrendous erosion in human rights. You know what I'm talking about, indefinite detentions, military tribunals, torture. It's been just an extraordinary phenomenon that's going on here. And the irony that strikes me is that in the propaganda campaign against the Chavez government, corporate media in this country are trying to paint Venezuela as being a human rights violator with no democracy. And I wondered what your response is to that.
Well, listen, you know, in Latin America, we have a history of dictatorships that harassed people, that didn't respect human rights at all. And they were very backed up by the U.S. government at the time. In Venezuela, we have a democracy, a full democracy, that sustains elections whenever it's needed. And it's claimed by the people. For example, when someone took the signatures to ask for a recall referendum to take place, it was called on. All these other things that complement democracy, like freedom of speech, freedom of press, in Venezuela, they're amply executed. As an example, we have never shut down any TV station in Venezuela, never have closed down any newspaper in Venezuela.
Justice Vegas, we're so thrilled, Heidi and Dahlia and Michael and I, to have you here. We've been longtime supporters of the Cuban Revolution, and we're very optimistic about the process that's going on in Venezuela. And out of really a sense of solidarity with our brothers and sisters south of us, to see you here in the United States and on this tour, and you know, we're all supporters of the Lawyers Guild, which is helping to build your tour. Wonderful thing for us to have you here. And I wanted to ask you to comment on this, because one of our great concerns is the campaign that the United States has been waging against the Chavez government in trying to get him thrown out, even unofficially, with Robertson, who speaks for the right wing in this country, indicating that he'd like to see Chavez assassinated, and then, you know, apologizing, but not really apologizing. And all of us are concerned about the threats that Venezuela is under now because of what it's trying to do. So to see a person in your position here in the United States traveling around and getting the truth out is really a welcome thing for all of us here at Law and Disorder.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your concept. Of course, this is an effort to bring the truth out, because you have a blockade established through the media. So when you hear so many things like Chavez is a dictator, you know, you imagine, well, he's a dictator. A dictator puts people in prison. A dictator persecutes you. The dictator host, you know, harasses you. And you see how the opposition people go on the screen every day and to say any kind of things about President Chavez and his followers. From there, go to work or to their home to sleep. And again, next day, they come back on the same screen and they start saying the same old bad things and mean things that Chavez goes. And every day after day, and nothing happens to them, you know? So it seems like Mickey Mouse. It's funny when you see that No newspaper has been shut down. No TV station has been closed. When you see the people of the opposition demonstrate, a very small amount of them, because they are not big anymore. They are very, very short of people. But they demonstrate. They go and the signs, whatever signs they want to carry, they carry. Whatever consigns they want to shout, they shout.
Not here.
So that's ridiculous.
Well, we're familiar with that process. We saw it unfold in Chile with a mobilization of the middle classes against the Allende government. Mm-hmm. And it's heartening to hear that they're shrinking and losing their influence. But they've got the United States behind them, pumping out the misinformation and generating fear. And
giving money.
And giving money through the National Endowment for Democracy is implicated in trying to overthrow the democratically elected government
case,
of Venezuela.
That's a good case you have there. You know, SUMATI is a society organization, non-governmental society.
Yeah, NGO, we call it.
NGO, all right. But all they take care is about politics. I mean, they don't take care of environment, health care, abandoned children. All they do is talk and say and act about politics. So they're like a political party. And they are receiving money from a foreign state. What would happen here in the States if it was the other way around? Wouldn't that be a felony, a federal felony?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, so how can they do it to us? We can't do it here. Why don't they send money to some organization in France to keep democracy going? I don't think the French will cope with it, nor the German. So, you know, it's about respect each other, you know. We're a country, a sovereign country, and we stand as that. So let's talk, you know, from equal. Maybe you can help me, maybe I can help you. Maybe we don't have anything to talk about, but over all things, we have to respect each other.
I have a question. I'm trying to recall, what year was the attempted coup? 2003, as I recall? Against Chavez.
Against Chavez?
Yeah.
202.
202. Now,
April.
You were there at the time, right?
Yes.
Can you just give us some of your reactions while that was unfolding and what was going on? I mean, we, of course, here followed it closely. Some of our newspapers, like the New York Times, even endorsed the coup, which was really shocking to us. There was an Endowment for Democracy issue here where the U.S. was supporting it. But I'm interested in your reaction as a Venezuelan while you were in Venezuela as it was unfolding.
Yes. Something, what was happening on the street was completely different of what's being shown on the screens. On the streets, just around the presidential palace, people were killed by sharpshooters from the buildings. I was there. I saw it. People that just fell right beside you with a bullet in his head.
And those were not Chavez people. Those were the coup people.
Right. They were caught. They grabbed them. People grabbed them. People consigned them to the police there in Palacio de Miraflores. And the thing is that they let him go. These few hours, the power changed hands, they let him go.
But you were outside the palace while the coup was going on.
Yes, of course. Let me tell you, the pictures were taken. Those exist, the pictures of the guys. One was North American. We had Colombians.
Why were they doing that, though?
Well, they needed to create a situation to accuse Chavez of massacring people.
This was before the actual coup.
This
happened before the coup,
There was a big demonstration of the opposition in the eastern part of the city.
Right.
They decided they were going to march against the palace. So Chavez were around the palace.
Chavez's soldiers were around the palace.
No, the people.
Or the Chavez's people
Chavez's followers. They never really arrived to the Palacio de Miraflores. They passed the palacios and tried to get it from the rear guard.
The opposition.
Right. So these pictures that were shown of some Chavez firing their pistols against someone that you didn't see, they were firing at the police that were firing at them. Right. There was no opposition people there. Like it's demonstrated later around in all these movies they have made, this documentary they have made, taken from the same TV station. Because the TV station took the whole thing, but they edited them and they cut this part off.
When the courts told them,
you have to bring me the complete tape, then it was shown.
They did it so that it would appear that Chavez's people were shooting the demonstrators,
right?
But in fact, what was happening, what many people think, as you do, is that these were some kind of paid agents or somebody to try and make it appear that Chavez was actually killing demonstrators. Yes. So that was the beginning of the coup, right? And then what happened after that?
Even more. When the militaries go out to declare before the TVs, the TV cameras, that they have on search against President Chavez to topple him, they said that already 14 people have died, shot on the streets, and that have, and no one had died yet. The death started to occur an hour later or so.
And that was the same day that Chavez was taken prisoner?
Yes. At night, Chavez went to talk to the military to try to convince them. So they seized him, they detained him, and they disappeared him.
I'm going to ask you the last question about this, which is always, I've always wondered about. Why didn't the military kill Chavez when he was their prisoner?
I think they got scared. Too many people were on the streets. It was amazing to see the millions of people that went down on the streets like water, you know, from the hills and every big city in the country. It was amazing. And they surrounded all these military compounds.
This is a good example.
Millions of people, millions of people in the streets. This is what we need. This on the anniversary of the war this year, the streets were anemic. That's what we need. Millions of people out on the street. It changes things.
It's a power of people. Yeah, but people are organized. See, in our country, we don't have a very strong labor movement anymore. We've got two parties, both reflect pretty much the same interests, although the Democrats try to appear more progressive. But we really have two capitalist parties, and that's it. And we don't have our own independent organizations, and we don't even have a real strong grassroots peace movement either. We've had some big demonstrations, but mostly as a response to getting an email on the internet. You know, we're not that well organized here. In some respects, Venezuela is, you know, much, much more organized than we are in the ability of people to be in organizations that fight for their own interests.
You know, during the coup, all communications were disrupted. They were jammed. There were two ships right in front of the coast from this country.
Oh, really?
They jammed all communications. So you were unable to use your cell phone, for example.
There were two ships outside the water from the United States.
Yes, from the United States. They jammed the
jammed the cell phones.
So
yeah, that's our
so
future.
You were unable to use your cell phone. No one could use their cell phones. But nevertheless, people, by communicating directly with each other, we call it radio, mouth radio, they got the message correctly. Chavez didn't resign. Chavez is alive. Chavez is in prison. So they went out. They went out immediately by the thousands. It's like you were pouring water down the streets. It was amazing.
Yeah. And people, I understand, in Venezuela are organized in many different parties. In our country, we have two parties. In Venezuela, there are a whole number of parties, all of which are in a coalition that support, although they're critical in some respects of Chavez, but support Chavez. And it's in a sense, a much broader and more participatory democracy that you have. We could take lessons from you, which leads me to make a request of you. Please invite all four of us. We're all lawyers and our producer. If you want to reciprocate and have us down there, we're ready to come.
You're invited, all of you.
Thank you very much. This was great. Yeah.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you so much.
Good luck down
It is a real honor to have you with us and to share this experience with our listeners. So thank you. We know you're exhausted, and you have an incredible schedule all across the United States, and we're so pleased and honored that you could join us here on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for your patience and overall with my Tarzanic English. But
no, it was good.
Perfect.
We've been listening to the face of the future here. Create 2-3 Venezuelas, maybe more.
Absolutely. Very pleased to have with us a special guest, Bertel Ullman, who is a professor of political science at NYU, an author of many books, including my favorite, How to Get Good Grades and Change the World. It was a book that I gave to Michael Ratner's son, Jake. I don't know whether it worked. At least he hasn't changed the world yet, but he does get good grades. Bertel Ullman is on the show today because he and a number of other people who we'll talk about have just launched the International Endowment for Democracy. Bertel, welcome to Law and Disorder, and tell us, what is the International Endowment for Democracy?
Thank you for asking. Everyone has heard of the National Endowment for Democracy. So let me start by saying a word about what that is and why we've started something called the International Endowment for Democracy. The National Endowment for Democracy has been around for over 20 years, and it basically gets money from the United States government to subvert regimes abroad that Washington disapproves of, all in the name, as we read almost every day in the newspaper, all in the name of promoting democracy and democratic nation building. The International Endowment for Democracy is an attempt to do just the opposite. Now, that requires, of course, a few words of explanation. What is the opposite? Well, the opposite is to try to get some money from abroad to support democracy in the country that needs it most, which is the USA. Needs it most, not because we're the worst dictatorship in the world, of course not, but because what our increasingly undemocratic, indeed anti-democratic government is doing in America and around the world is having a greater negative effect on people all over the world than the actions of any other government on the planet.
I think you could probably say that unless we really get some genuine democracy here in the United States, there's no democracy anywhere in the world that's safe, is it?
Well, the connection with democracy is this, because some people will say, yes, the government's doing all that and people all over are hurting from our military, economic, and ecological policies and non-policies abroad. But what's all this got to do with democracy here? What it has to do is that these same policies are hurting American citizens. Most Americans don't have any interest in those policies. And if democracy worked, really worked, the way we're told it does, these policies would be done away with in an instant. And it's only because our government has been involved in various acts which have reduced an already pretty shabby democracy into one which is now, I think, hardly working, that they're able to get away serving interests which are not the interests of the American people nor of the citizens of the world, but of a small minority of people who have power and wealth and are doing whatever they can to increase both.
I noticed on the press release that there are a number of people with a great degree of moral authority that have joined with you in setting up the International Endowment for Democracy. Can you tell us a bit who those other people are that you're working with?
Well, we have on the board of directors people like Gore Vidal, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Ramsey Clark, Howard Zinn, Michael Smith even, and Michael Ratner. Basically, we have about 35 pretty well-known progressive scholars, lawyers, and activists who are not only disgusted by what America is doing abroad, but by this constant chatter of doing it in the name of democracy. If having a bomb dropped on your house hurts you in all sorts of evident ways, being told that all this is for your good because it's spreading democracy in your country is equally painful psychologically. So we're looking around for a way to involve the people of the world. I think this is a first. In some way, even if it's a minor way, in some way, in the struggle to bring real democracy to the United States, to solve the problems from which the American citizens are suffering, but to solve the problems that are being created and exacerbated around the world and therefore causing suffering among people everywhere by the U.S. government.
Can you tell our listeners what some of your planned activities are?
Well, our major activity is to give people a chance to participate in what's going on in the United States by contributing sums, and we expect usually quite small sums, to us. And that's why it's important to have, I think, a sterling group of people who are known and respected, not just by Americans, but by people elsewhere, to us. And we won't spend the money. No one connected with our group, no member of the board of directors, is receiving any salary. We'll pass it on to some of the many groups which are out there. It's not as if there aren't many groups which are struggling to not not just defend what's left of our vanishing democracy, but to develop a better one, a more egalitarian one, one which is truly allows the people a strong say in their lives. And we will try to, you know, pass what we get on to those groups in education, in the working class movement, of course, in the media, and also in that growing but still too small effort to try to let people know about our last two stolen elections, what can and should have been done because of those thefts.
Now, Bert, if you want to give money, find out more about it, you have a website, right?
Yes.
What is that website?
The website is www.internationalendowmentfordemocracy.org, one word, or another website, www.iefd.org, IEFD.org. And you'll find our appeal, which Michael Smith has already mentioned, on there in 13 languages because we want to be read by the people of the world. And a lot of related material, including a huge critical democracy library, which we hope will be widely used in high schools and colleges to give people an insight into what's wrong with our democracy and what was wrong with it even before the last two stolen elections. That is to say, especially the role that big money plays in buying up the preconditions, the necessary preconditions for democracy to exist even in politics.
Now, it's called the International Endowment for Democracy.
Yes.
The one the U.S. has set up is called what?
The National Endowment
for
Democracy.
I want people to get that clear. It's International Endowment for Democracy.
Right.
The U.S. one is the National Endowment, and they have give money to the Republican and Democratic Party through that. Is that right?
They get money from Congress.
Right.
And they do work, according to one of their first leaders, who said back in the early 80s, that was done earlier by the CIA. So basically they are a front organization for the government and for the CIA and do all these things like help overturn the government, the democratically elected government of Haiti, to try to do the same to the democratically elected government of Venezuela. And they've been doing that sort of thing in many countries around the world, always in the name of promoting democracy when they're usually doing the exact opposite.
No, it's remarkable. I remember when it was set up in the 80s and there was a well-known congressman, Crockett, who was quite radical, member of the National Lawyers Guild, and he came to me and says, Michael, this is ridiculous. How can they set up something like this? They're just going to be funneling money, essentially, the Democrats, Republicans, and a couple of labor unions or something.
They had some connections with such groups, sure.
And but how can they do that? And it's exactly what you said. Well, it's basically a CIA front, in some way, doing the work of the CIA. Rather.
Right. But what's so interesting is that what their talk of democracy strikes anybody who knows the least bit about what they're doing in these countries as total hypocrisy.
Right.
And yet, there's more talk about this, that is to say, promoting democracy today when the government is further away from furthering democracy here or anywhere else than ever before. And that is, I think, an interesting question to ask. Why more talk about democracy when there's less practice? And I think there is a connection. I think, in fact, the talk is meant to hide the practice, the anti-democratic practice. So they talk the talk more because they walk the walk.
So
less.
When Bush talks about Venezuela and when he talks about the Middle East and bringing democracy, he's basically doing the opposite.
But he's also hiding the opposite with that talk because though we see through it easily, there are so many people who vote for Bush or could have voted for him who really think that there must be some substance to it because they read about it every day in the papers. And the truth is that this is hiding a substance made up of the exact opposite.
We're speaking with Bertel Ullman, who's the head of and has just launched. It's really a wonderful group, the International Endowment for Democracy. It's a parody of the National Endowment for Democracy.
No, they're a parody of us.
And it's also an organization that has the most extraordinary website, been compiled by 35 activists and scholars. Bertel, tell us a little bit more about the website and give us that website again, will you?
Okay. IEFD.org. And it contains, as well as this huge critical democracy library, about 100 articles divided into sections on stolen elections. There's an awful lot of material there, which will prove it to anybody except maybe George Bush and Mr. Diebold, the guy who owns most of the electronic voting devices, that these elections were stolen. Another big section on American democracy, Another big section on the National Endowment for Hypocrisy Democracy, which is a word
we'd like to insert into their title? And finally, a key section on, is democracy compatible with capitalism? Because it's a question we have to ask. If it turns out that the preconditions for a really functioning political democracy is a degree of social economic equality, which is impossible in capitalist society, then those of us who really favor democracy, and I think most Americans really do, I consider it America's favorite virtue, then those of us who really favor democracy have to think about what kind of social and economic system we have to go along with it. As one of my favorite thinkers has said, Dick Gregory, great philosopher and comedian, if democracy is such a good thing, let's have more of it. Fantastic, fantastic idea. It is a great thing. And let's have more of it, not just political democracy, but social and economic and cultural. And coming from a university, I have to add, educational democracy.
You're going to get our help, Bertel. It's the International Endowment for Democracy, IEFD.org, internationalendowmentfordemocracy.org. All of us give you a real hearty thank you for doing this. We'll put up a link on our website. People can go to lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you, Bert. And people may not know this, but you know, Bert was probably one of the most famous professors at NYU when he was teaching, still teaches there, Marxism. I actually took a course, part of his course in Marxism in the 70s. Well, he doesn't remember. I ordered it, and I wasn't at NYU. And, you know, I remember him showing how where the, he had piles of monopoly money in different hands. And, like, the bosses wound up with all the money in the end. And out of that, I know Bert developed a game called Class Struggle, which was one of the great board games around for a number of years. So it's been great to have you. And this idea, I just love, Bert, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You owe me a paper yet, Mike. I'll change your grade when I get the paper.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work. Who me? I'm cooling in New York. I'm chilling in New York. The hoods is on my block and the brothers at the court. The baseball hats is on and the projects is calm. Dream time's extended and highly recommended. But early birds like me's up checking out the scene. The early worms jog. Forget about your job. Just come dig the essence while the decadence is hidden. When people act like people, the theory isn't pigeon. If you know the norm, it's like Hades transformed. On Sunday's early hours, the city sprouts its flowers. So get with the rhythms while you get in with the planets. Vibe off the jams, but don't take them for granted. Just chill. We venture through the streets in search of funky beats. Extensive is the travels and it's heavy on the sneaks.
Yeah, it's kicking out the speakers of the Sunday morning Jeepers.
My man, the planets do it lovely.
Am I my brother's keeper?
We foot it to the park where the swoon units walk.
With the Phoenicians, digging on musicians.
Hanging with the rebels, sipping on a Snapple.
Bugging with my crew, just tripping in the apple.
You be thinking peace when you vibing with your flock.
But you be thinking, damn, everybody got a Glock.
If you got some beef, please express that in silence, or else, violence.
But right
violence.
Here is the life, it's the children of the concrete.
Living off the fruits and the functions of the fat beats.
Hip hop's all around, the members is growing.
Please dig on the sounds, cause the good vibes they snowing, so chill. So chill. Praying that a game's on. Maybe it's the running reps. Maybe it's the Knicks. Maybe it's a rerun of an old TV show like Hawaii 5-0 or Karate Flicks. Maybe if the phone rings, butterfly will take wings. Speaking on some cool things, fronting like I cope. Born under flat ground, now I'm chilling shaky ground. Reaching for Pacific Heights, Sunday is my rope. Dig it. Sunday's to relax. Sunday's to relax. Some Sunday morning drama is calling up my mama. The hotline is in, I guess the silver's new the deal. Vibing off the jams of the cruise on Sugar Hill. Lay around and think, ain't nothing to do. Checking out some From, some Sartre, Camus. Mingus is our Dan Roach can drum. The DPs are life, there they go, here they come. It's time to grab some loot, put on the timber boots. Checking out some dollies, like Tasha and Kamali. New York is a museum with its posters and graffiti. If you're in the city on Sunday, come check me, get with me.